In the English, it's 74. We got to the bottom of the page. And first of all, we're finishing up with the comments about Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. This is... We had been reading about Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. Now we're down on the left-hand side of the page. Amar Rabbi Hanina, Ein adam nokef etzba o milamata, ele im kein machrizin alav milamala. A person does not stub his toe down below, namely on earth, without there being a decree about it from above. In other words, this is the sense that nothing happens on this earth without it having been really decreed from above. Shenemar, Ne Hashem Mitzade Gaver Konanu, by Hashem are the steps of a man prepared, the Adam Ma Yavin Darko, and does a person understand the path he walks on? Okay? So in other words, everything comes from God. Everything comes from God. Now this is, on the one hand, you would take it as a generally perhaps an acceptable pious attitude that God is responsible for everything that goes on. But notice that it's a little bit more than that. If you stub your toe, it's not something that you want to happen. So if you say that everything comes from God, then this is a way of saying, first of all, that all the bad things that happen definitely happen with a divine hand that are behind them. So you have to realize that side of it. So it's potentially problematic. Now, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar then comments on the same thing. Dam nikuf meratzeh kedam ola. Literally here, the blood of stubbing the toe, meratzeh, is as acceptable as dam ola, as the blood of an offering, an ola, a burnt offering. Now that is to say, therefore, that when you suffer, suffering has a positive quality to it. And if God is responsible for all of your suffering, you attribute the suffering to Him, and there is a positive result of that. The positive result, you may not think that it's positive, because it means that God is responsible for these things, but in a way, God enables you to atone for your sins. So once you've suffered, you know that you have dealt with the deserved punishment that you should be coming your way. We are all sinners, you know, we're human beings, we're sinners. So you stub your toe, and that is like bringing a korban, like bringing the sacrifice. Amar Rava, Rava says, listen to Rava's comment on this, unless you think I'd just be blanketly arguing for this. Rava says, Begudal yamin ubenikuv sheni. This is talking about your right foot and the second time you stub it. Now, understand what he's talking about here. This may seem just like funny business, but I think that there is meaning behind this. The right foot is generally the dominant foot. Okay? So if you stub your left foot, right? I don't know about you, but when I do anything where I hurt my left side, I say to myself, you know, it's just the way I am. I don't have any control over my left side. I stub my left toe. I put my left hand in all kinds of places that I hurt it. I can't do a lot of things with my left side because it's not dominant. It's not dominant. So in a way, what happens with my left side happens by chance. gets the difference. Okay? It happens by chance. So what Rava is saying is, if you say that everything comes by God, you are excluding the possibility that some things just happen. Yes, all right, I'll tell you that they happen by God on your right side. That is to say, the side that you have control over, your dominant side. Okay? And even there, not the first time, but the second time. Everybody stubs their toe. So you're going to tell me that every time you stub your toe, God wants you to stub your toe? He said, no, that's not true. But that God never wants you to stub your toe? I wouldn't say that either. It's the second time you stub your toe. The first time, we chalk up to chance. We just, these kind of things happen. The second time, we chalk it up to God's direction. Okay? And where then something comes in God's direction, it has a purgative power. It is mechaper. It is purgative. It is atoning. And therefore, it atones for sin. Okay? So here you see, even in this tiny little piece, two different views, I think. You see the views of the rabbis who are very comfortable with the idea that God is responsible for everything, and then other rabbis who say, not so fast. Not so fast. Any comments here so far? Yes.
Two questions. One is, I understand about being modest, but why the suffering? And number two, since when Jewish blood? Since when human blood is korban blood?
Okay. When we don't have the sacrificial system anymore, okay, then we're dependent on achieving atonement without sacrifices. And one of the ways that you might say we achieve atonement is when we suffer. Right? Suffering could be accorded some ultimate value, as it frequently is in religion, that if suffering comes from God, there has to be a reason why God makes us suffer, and therefore it always has to be a positive reason, and the reason would be for suffering. These are yisurim. Yisurim. That's the concept of yisurim and atonement. So, human blood, it's a way, I think, of just exaggerating the point. In fact, it's any suffering. But here, you're talking about injury. And therefore, it's a nice image, just if you injure to the extent you hurt yourself and you bleed, that blood is indicative of blood that's on the altar. Okay, I think it's just a literary image, really.
I'm very interested in the role of chance in biologic phenomena.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm particularly interested in the issue of how Jewish views of chance are played out. Because one could make the argument that, in fact, it is exactly in those things that are chance phenomena that God's hand might be most easily discerned.
It's possible. Correct.
So correct. I was just wondering if it's not too much of a digression to just make...
I would just say that I think you see a tension here. It's not a simple issue, and there isn't one view. And here you see two different views. I should have gone a little bit further. I see that I didn't complete the thought there. There was yet one other caveat. It was Bigudal Yamin, the right toe, right big toe, Uvenikuf Sheni, the second time, Behud Ka'azil Idvar Mitzvah. And that is when a person is going to do a mitzvah. So in other words, the cards are all stacked. This is Rava's point of view. Okay, this is not the point of view of Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina has a much more blanket sense of God's involvement in everything, in absolutely everything, including chance. There really is no such thing as chance, because everything that we interpret as chance is really part of the divine plan, even though we don't understand it. But that doesn't mean that it's not part of the divine plan. But you can see Rava feels that that's going too far. And in truth, you have this dichotomy of views all the way till today. That's why people like myself, if I read the Art Scroll, you occasionally see the way they interpret things. In Art Scroll, in the Haredi world, they have absolutely no problem with attributing everything to God. And it's all from God. Whereas some of us would like a little bit more to either be human responsibility or to be left to chance, but in the following way. Chance is chance as much as chance can be in a world that's governed by laws, by natural laws. Okay, so I assume that's what you guys would probably deal with, that there are natural laws, and there may be patterns in the natural phenomena, even though we can't necessarily see those patterns, even if they're patterns of chaos. Chaos even has patterns.
But you can take a very simple example, whether a child will be a boy or a girl.
Okay.
From a medical standpoint, that's where biology chooses chance as a way of ensuring that there are roughly equal numbers of boys and girls. But any given child, you don't know. But you know, in the United States this year, roughly 50% will be
correct.
But any single one, you have
you,
no
you
knowledge.
Don't know. You don't know. And that kind of problem exists in religion too. Because the temptation is to say that God governs every sperm and egg. Right? That could be possible. Or it could be that God doesn't. So where do you go from there?
Right. Well, I mean, it's okay because you can always say that God chooses 50-50.
Okay,
by
there
the
you
end
go.
Of the year, it all correct. Averages out.
God is not interested in each individual activity, but is interested in the general quantitative results.
Do we need to extend the discussion to include how long each child lives to even out the sense of chance, and
it's
does
also
that
possible.
Child reach maturity to reproduce?
Correct. All those
I
things
mean,
are.
It seems it's not just a finite set of chances at the very moment of conception.
Correct. But it could be. I mean, those are
evening out. I mean, I'm sorry. To even out, how does science take that into account, Barry?
Well, I don't want to get too far into it, but I mean, I'm just saying that this is one of the most easy to intuit. Mm-hmm. We have many other examples. How often you have a mutation in a gene is a chance phenomenon, and many other chance phenomena that are directly related to biology and related to human disease. So they come to bear on the questions that often strike people most when something mm-hmm. bad happens, and then you're left to try to explain them to someone in language that is accessible and understandable.
Yeah, I wouldn't say much more beyond what we said.
When Romeo Lozaro says that the blood of stubbing atones, like the blood of the Olah offering, and he's thinking about animal sacrifice versus human sacrifice, is that something that he might have had in the back of his mind? Is this an idea?
I think that's going too far. Because I don't think that he would allow for the possibility of human sacrifice.
No.
Not in our religion. Indeed, there are in other religions, but I think he's referring to common experience here. You know, all of us know
just
the experience.
Expressing.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Does it ever come up in discussion about
human sacrifice?
I don't mean as either permissible or prohibited, but just the idea of it in other biblical pagan.
Oh, it's in the Bible, so it comes up in the Talmud, sure.
It does.
Because it's considered a reprehensible practice. So one of the worst things are the Maaseh Molech, the deeds of Molech. And Molech was the god that asked for human sacrifice. So it's one of the most terrible of practices, and comes up both in the Bible and the Talmud. Not to be followed. Not a good idea. Okay?
I guess what was bothering me a little is that bringing in all our offerings intentional and covering the toe isn't. And so it's sort of like the word atone was bothering me. It's almost like the suffering in a way somehow equalizes or offsets whatever it is you need to atone for, but it's in very limited circumstances, and so Rava was kind of limiting when the pain brought about by chance creates this offset.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think this is a literary image because you can't push it too far. And Ola is really not the right kind of sacrifice to discuss in the first place. You probably want a chatat, a sin offering. Right? So it is using imagery from the sacrificial system, and certainly in Rava's time, the sacrificial system has been gone already 250 years. So that's not unusual that we use that he would use such imagery. I wouldn't go too far with it beyond that. Okay, here it is that there is a value to suffering, and that there is an atoning value to suffering. And that's not a simple idea, but that is the idea that I think is being expressed here. Okay, we go on. Now, final comments about Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. You remember Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair? He was the fellow with the donkey, who was the from donkey, who wouldn't eat the food that hadn't been tithed. And you remember Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair wouldn't allow himself to be the guest in the home of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He avoided it because he didn't want to be obligated, having been the guest, at Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's home. So a final comment about him. Amru alav al Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. He said the following about Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. Mi amav lo batza al prusa she'ena shalom. Throughout all of his days, he never broke bread over any piece of bread that was not his. Right? So that's just the nature of the piety of this man. We're at the bottom of 7b. Umiyom she'amad al dato. From the day that he, it says he matured intellectually, that's not bad, that is, his mind matured. Lo nehene misu'udat aviv. He no longer derived benefit from his father's meal. Now, those of you who have children who are still dependent upon you, this is the opposite kind of view. That his own sense of independence, he did not want to have his father dependent upon him, and from the time that he was able to support himself, he never was comfortable even being at his father's table. So this is a very extreme position, as you can well imagine, but it is the position of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. You like to cultivate it a little bit? Okay.
Do you agree with footnote 37, or do you think the rabbis might have thought he was a little shut
down? Footnote 37, what does it say? It is proper to avoid taking gifts from others. One who practices in the extreme is not considered haughty or antisocial, but praiseworthy. I don't know. I think that Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair is an extreme example of piety. Some arguments can be made for some of this piety. I mean, as I think you just heard, reaction to children being forever dependent on their parents. This is, you know, the other extreme. But such is the nature of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. The stories that we have read are classic in terms of his personality. Most of the material on Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair is in this section of Masechet Chulin. But there is one other passage that I wanted to read to you that is in the Tractate of Avodah Zarah. And there is a Braita of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair here in Avodah Zarah. And I'll read it to you first. It's a little difficult to translate, but it becomes very important in later Jewish literature. Amar Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. This is Daf Kaf Amud Bet, 20b, in the Tractate Avodah Zarah. Amar Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair said the following. Torah Nidia Liyadei Zehirut. Torah brings us to the stage of Zehirut. I don't really know how to translate Zehirut. Zehirut is carefulness,
cautiousness,
sensitivity. Sensitivity, that's a good word. I like that word, sensitivity. Okay? Zehirut, nidia liyidei zerizut. So this cautiousness or sensitivity leads to zerizut. Usually it's translated as zealousness, but I don't think it's zealousness. Zerizut is...
Paying attention to details, being attentive to details, which makes you more efficient and makes you more productive.
Very good. Could be zrizut is attention to details. Zariz in the Talmud tends to be the desire of a person to get up and go, you know, to do something. It's an active sense of a person. So zehirut leads to zrizut. Zrizut nidiyal yedei nekiut. That get up and go leads to nekiut. Now nekiut with nun kuf yud vav taf.
Nekiut.
Nekiut. So nekiut literally is cleanliness. Cleanliness. Now I don't know whether it means cleanliness. It could be purity. Purity. That, or purity of intention. Okay. Okay. Nikiyut nidiyal yedei frishut. Frishut. Right. Nikiyut, this purity, leads to frishut. Frishut is asceticism. It's separation. The person separating himself from others. Frishut nidiyal yedei tohora. Right. This kind of separateness leads to purity. Now, this means purity. This is Torah's clearly purity. Torah nivial yedei chasidut. Purity leads to piety. To piety. Chasidut nivial yedei anava. Piety leads to humility. Anava nivial yedei yirat chet. Humility leads to the fear of sin. Yirat chet nidial yedei kedusha. The fear of sin leads to holiness. Kedusha nidial yedei ruach hakodesh. And fear of sin leads to the Holy Spirit. Ruach hakodesh. Ruach hakodesh nidial yedei tchiyat ametim. And the Holy Spirit leads to the resurrection of the dead. Now it's a fascinating agglomeration of ideas here. Starting out with relatively simple ideas, the first one of which is Torah. That seems the normal thing. But realize, I just want to emphasize what I have said before in discussing Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. The whole notion here of piety is one that begins with Torah, but goes way beyond Torah. Torah is the beginning, that is the first step here is of Torah. Whereas we would normally go in exactly the opposite direction. You develop the self, you go to here, and maybe you'll get to Torah. Here, step one is Torah. But Torah is by no means the end. Torah is just the beginning of the development of the pious mentality. And that leads all the way to Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, really means almost that a person has tremendous powers. If one is in contact with Ruach HaKodesh, then one has miracle powers. Excuse me? It's Nidiyut. It's prophecy. It's the notion of prophecy is possible. And if it ultimately leads to Tchiyat HaMetim, I don't honestly know what that means. Either that means that the individual has the possibility of resurrecting the dead, which you see in the Bible.
Yeah, like
you see Elijah does that, Elisha does that, they resurrect the dead. So here the whole process is one of enormous power. Now, if you keep in mind, let's say, the miracles of Christianity, miracles attributed to Jesus, these are similar ideas. But here, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, this becomes almost mainline in the development of what we call in Judaism the history of Musar. Musar are the pietistic movements, particularly in Eastern Europe, but not only limited to Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe especially, but also to some extent in the Sephardi world. There was a book written in the 18th century by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzatel called Mesilat Yesharim. Some of you may have had contact with this book, because Mesilat Yesharim, the Path of the Upright, was probably the most famous Jewish book until Zionism. The book Mesilat Yesharim was read widely. If anyone read anything beyond the classic sources, namely the Bible and the Talmuds, maybe the codes, it was the book Mesilat Yesharim. It was the standard text. Finally, in Hasidut, by the time we get to the late 18th and the early 19th centuries, Mesilat Yesharim is a central piece of the corpus. In the non-Hasidic world, in the world of Musar, as we say, in the Lithuanian yeshivas, for example, the basic book was Mesilat Yesharim. Students would come, they would study, and they would study the classic sources, and then they would study Musar books. And the first book of all Musar books was Mesilat Yesharim. Mesilat Yesharim is based entirely on the Braita of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. That is the structure of the book. The book begins by quoting the Braita of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair that I've just quoted to you. And it then has a section on each of these ideas in order to flesh them out. Okay? Because as you saw as we went through it, the Hebrew is hard to understand. And really, these are concepts. They're concepts of behavior that Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzatel, develops further in Mesilat Yesharim. So powerful was Mesilat Yesharim that even in the world of Haskalah, Mesilat Yesharim had an impact. And one of the most amazing examples of that was Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan. You know Kaplan's writing. Kaplan was the rabbi of the Jewish Center on the West Side. He was the professor at the seminary for many, many years. He was the founder of naturalism in modern Jewish philosophy. And Kaplan decided that he would work on one classic volume. And what he did was that he translated for the Jewish Publication Society Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzatel's book Mesilat Yesharim. And to this day, that is the best English translation, is Kaplan's translation. Nobody realizes that Kaplan did this. But it was published together with the original on one side of the page, and we have it somewhere here in this library. It's the classic English version. Others have been done in the yeshiva world. Nothing compares to Kaplan's edition of Silat Yesharim. The only problem with Kaplan is that he cut out certain parts of the book that he didn't like. He was a modern philosopher, and therefore, when he felt that Silat Yesharim would never talk too much about otherworldly things, he just cut it out. So it'd be interesting to just create an edition that shows where Kaplan skipped things. But other than that, Kaplan's translation is really, it's masterful, absolutely masterful translation into English. But this is all based on Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. Okay? Yes.
Occurred to me, and I would like to offer a suggestion only for that Tfiyat HaMeitim, the final ultimate stage. I don't think it refers to someone being able to perform a miracle such as Elisha, but rather to the incarnation or reincarnation of the soul as a reward for this purity. The notion of reincarnation was prevalent in the ancient world, and it also came from India to the Lord's.
Oh, that's a good idea.
But the
that the person who is the pure person will be resurrected.
The problem with the... Right, but there is a lot about reincarnation of the soul into what form of life, higher form, lower form.
Uh-huh.
So if you punishment, you come back as a dog or something.
Right.
But, so it doesn't say that. What I hear is
uh-huh.
a better logical deduction from the sequence of purity. Like a reward
for
the higher soul.
I think that's very possible. I don't agree with you, but I think that it's a very good idea.
I just made it up.
It's a good idea. You may be right. Yes, Mommy.
When I was thinking with the Ruach HaKodesh, I thought that the Holy Spirit would be God himself, and that this maybe raising of the dead would be the Messianic age.
Mm-hmm. And that's also possible, that what we're talking about here is a series of steps leading to a messianic age. And in fact, when we all take these steps, the end result will be the messianic age will be upon us. It's very possible. Very possible.
All right. I think Maimonides says in the Shloshes Ikarim, the last one is Tchiyat HaMitim,
right.
That we must believe in this.
Correct. It's the basic principle of the faith.
Right. So it looks like they are pushing you, Tchiyat HaMitim, to a belief of a concept that maybe was not there. Maybe they tried to sell something that didn't exist.
Well, in the Talmud in Masechet Sanhedrin, there's a whole chapter devoted to that, and that's exactly what they do in that chapter. They try to prove that the resurrection from the dead can be proven from the Torah. Okay? Have you read the Torah? It's not actually there.
It's not
directly there. So they prove to you how it's there, because it's not there. So that's one of the nice things to see how they prove it.
But why they try to sell it?
I don't want to get too much into that. Maybe we'll do that another time. But it is very basic in Rabbinic Judaism, the belief in the resurrection of the dead. Whether it is a reaction against, let us say, the Greek notion of the immortality of the soul, which is a belief in some sort of spiritual immortality. And it is said that the Bible believes not only in the value of the soul, but the other piece, which is the body. And the way in which you give the body an ultimate value is it too is immortal. It's a little bit different from the soul because it doesn't have an instantaneous immortality the way the soul does. We say when the soul leaves the body, the soul has its own immortality. But the body itself will have an immortality when it reunites with the soul. So some have said that it's a way of developing the idea in Judaism of the importance of the body, whereas you don't have that in the classical tradition. I mean, the classical non-Jewish tradition. That's one possibility. But it's a big subject. Jim?
I don't remember the order of all the things. That's all right. But it's struck me that you're on the faith further down the road than I would have expected. It almost seems as though that would have been one of the first steps that came after. I don't remember all the things that came after.
You're right. It comes sort of far down the list. It's anava mevi'a li yedei yirachet mevi'a li yedei kedusha, kedusha mevi'a li yedei ruach hakodesh, and so on. So it's pretty far down the list. Yirachet, Your point is well taken. Yirat chet, I don't think, is what we think of as the fear of sin. I think, how can I say it?
Avoidance?
No, it's more than that. It's the personality, it's the person who sort of is able, doesn't even have to resist temptation. Okay? There is a level of moral development, and I don't know whether moral is the right word, a level of pietistic development, where temptation loses its hold. It's a nice thing to think about. Very hard thing to achieve. Okay? My sense of the Yirat Chet is that. You're talking about something like that. Okay? That's why it's further down. It's really a pretty hard thing to achieve.
Does any of this have any connection to the ideas about the 36 holy people that keep the world upright?
Well, that's a much later idea. That's a much later idea, but it's not totally separate. It's not totally separate. We were talking about that the other day. That has certain clear non-Jewish sources. But in those communities, let's say in the Hasidic world, the Eastern European world, where this caught on, the notion of the 36, it's the same world that read Nisi Ladja Sharim. So I don't know that it's a tit for a tat here, that one leads to the other, but they're both in that same world. Very popular in that world. No?
I actually was surprised that asceticism was in this theory, because I didn't think that it was so valued. I actually thought you were going to stop there and be righteous, and then you continue to the highest thing. So, obviously, there have been different times, but it obviously goes with, what's his name, Mary Pinchas?
Pinchas Ben Yair.
Because I think someone who doesn't need a meal for anybody else. Essentially, he's eating his meals by himself.
Right. You could see that personality could lead to asceticism.
Yeah, but it's considered so now when it was translated again and described and everything, asceticism had a positive spin.
In this, yes. In Pinchas Ben Yair, yes, and it did in Eastern Europe as well. If you read Chaim Glader's book, The Yeshiva. You ever read Chaim Glader? Oh, there's also somewhere here. Once we get our catalog, our card catalog going, it'll all be at our fingertips. But I made sure we got, it's in two volumes in English, Chaim Glader, The Yeshiva. These days you can probably get it at Amazon, get an old copy. It is a masterpiece, absolute masterpiece. Brings you into the world of the Musa Yeshivas, post-World War One, and the people who were there and the way in which they would almost flagellate themselves. He describes how, for example, how the students in the yeshivas would go into a store and they would buy nails and they would then tell the person that they wanted more nails. And then they would say that they didn't want the nails. The person would yell at them. So the whole point of it was to get abused. It was to make sure that a non-involved party would actually yell at you. And it was to create situations where other people would put you to the test.
We're not allowed to do that. We said we cannot go to a store and say
that you don't want to buy. This is Musar. Musar goes beyond. In Musar, there is every effort made to make it difficult and to create personality by suffering. Professor Alan Nadler, who was the director of YIVO for a while, wrote a wonderful book on the style of Musser in the late 19th and early 20th century. And it's such a good book, nobody has read this book, because it's the least popular book, because it's so against the grain of what we're interested in. so against our modern way of thinking of things that when Alan wrote this book, it was a wonderful book. I was so excited to see this. It was a complete flop. Nobody wanted to read it. Look up Alan Nadler. It's called something like The History of Musser, or something like that. It's M-U-S-A-R. It's a wonderful book, just a wonderful study. And some of you, I had teachers like this who came out of the Musser world. What they would do to us as students is that they would make us suffer. This used to be when it was less so by the time I got to the seminary. It was much more so in the few years before I got there, but I was at the end of that world, where the teachers would punish the students. And that was the only way to have any moral development, was if you punished somebody. There was a whole generation of parents who did that to their children. And it wasn't in order to, we today would psychologize those things and say, well, they were trying to get out their aggressions. But no way. This was considered to be good behavior. That's the way you... I saw an article on this in the New York Times this past Sunday in the magazine.
And then David Brooks just wrote an editorial.
And I read David Brooks, right.
It's a funny but,
it was the Wall Street Journal.
It was the Wall Street Journal.
It was about the Chinese parent. And the Chinese parent.
Tiger woman married to mother.
Correct, correct. So, you know, this stuff may come back. This kind of thing, you know, it's so...
She got slapped down by every American.
She has sold a lot of books, and her kids, your kids may shine her kids' shoes someday. I mean, that may be, you know, who knows what the future will be. This, all of our kids may be subject to their kids.
Her children came out with a tongue-in-cheek retort, saying people didn't understand how tongue-in-cheek her humor was.
Oh, well, that's possible. All of that is possible.
Because the military method, isn't it? To humiliate and
do you see it in the military?
It's
certainly not modern psychology.
Used to be in medicine as well.
It was all over. It was all over as well. It was all over.
How is putting that uninvolved person, forget about families, how is putting that uninvolved person in the example you gave, going to the shop for nails, how is that just they miss that? I mean, how is causing that stress or that aggravation, putting that person in a situation where he behaves that way?
It's just you're embarrassed in public. It's public embarrassment. You're in a store, and somebody yells at you, and you know, and everybody else knows that you've really been you've been impossible.
No, I mean the person who's you're hurting somebody.
Yeah. Oh, you're hurting.
You're forcing that person into a
using the person.
I'm not telling you to go and do this. I'm just describing to you the extremes to which some of these things have gone. And I describe it to you partly because we assume that Judaism is against all of this. You should just know that mainstream...
Oh, good, that makes it all right.
There's a lot of mainstream support for these extreme ideas. Okay? And you will see...
Today, where there's no support for extreme ideas.
Well, today... You know, some of these ideas are doing very well. Some of them are doing very well. And but that's Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair. Again, the key thing to me is that piety goes beyond the Torah. Piety goes beyond the Torah, rather than the Torah simply being the entry point for piety. Piety is the beginning of a process, but development of moral behavior, consciousness of divine presence, all of those things come afterwards.
Is
Mishilat Yesharim.
In its day, was it translated into Yiddish and other vernacular
languages? I don't know the answer to that. It's not complicated Hebrew, though. The Hebrew is accessible Hebrew. Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was a master stylist. Among other things, when he was the first modern Hebrew author. He wrote plays. He was an Italian. As Luzzatto, he was the beginning of the Luzzatto family. He was the first of the famous Luzzattos, that was in the middle of the 18th century. He was a person of the philosoph. He was a philosoph type, and sort of brought all these things to bear. So he's Hebrew. He wrote Hebrew plays, and the Silat Yesharim is beautiful Hebrew. It's just beautiful and very accessible. Very young.
Right, so, I mean, you start with Torah. I mean, they were not formed, they were not mature. They were starting with Torah before they got to any kind of real maturity and understanding.
Sure.
It's not a lab of death, it would have been a childhood death.
Even so, the assumption here was that a curriculum that was very Torah-based, even at a later age, needed a component that went beyond this. And that's not to be taken for granted. Even today, that's a controversial idea. When you're discussing curriculum in any school, whether you should have, or to what extent you should have, a piece of the curriculum that is developed, that's devoted to pietistic behavior, that's a real question. I saw that just last week, they translated it into English and was published, Feldheim published it, a book called Chovat HaTalmidim. Chovat HaTalmidim was written in Warsaw in the late 30s by the Piacesna Rebbe. He was the last Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto. And he wrote his sermons were later collected after the war. Some of his students hid them away. He was murdered, but his writing is just incredible. It's amazing stuff, the Avodat HaKodesh. But his book on development of piety, which is Chovat HaTalmidim, was just published last week in English. I was amazed to see that. And it is, again, another one of these books, the assumption being that as the student learns, he has to go beyond, he has to have a context in which to put his learning. And I think that's a very important idea in Torah study.
I'm just curious about how this was raised. Did the Rav Pinchas Ben Yair believe that one could pursue this path of piety as a member of the community? Or did it, it's not clear.
His recommendations are antisocial.
Yeah.
So, I think that Torah surely is something that is communal. You've got to have a teacher, you've got to be within the community, but his recommendations are also rather antisocial. So I think...
aggressively shrinking further and further away.
Correct.
I'm surprised the Talmud, which from what little I've studied, puts a premium on participation.
Well, the Talmud has more than one point of view. The Talmud is an agglomeration of many points of view. I'm sorry. Yes, it's. We have in the Talmud the Jay says the extreme of the Nazir.
That's supposed to be temporary.
But that is temporary, correct? This is a different idea. This is really quite different.
It almost sounds Buddhist.
Yes.
It's almost the individual achieving nirvana,
mm-hmm.
but now isolated,
mm-hmm.
and as opposed to the bodhisattva staying in the world,
yep.
and helping others, looks very much like that.
I think it is very much like that. And that's why when it was popular, it was very popular, and then it went out of style. May come back. I taught Ms. Yolanda Sharim a few times in the seminary. Students were crazy about it. I eventually lost interest in it because I didn't think it was deep enough. It's not a deep book, but that's part of its success. Success is that it's not all that deep, and that's why it was very popular. But it is along those lines, I agree. Okay, we move on. We're on Daf Chet Amud Aleph. And now we are going back to Shechita. Back to Shechita. You forgot about Shechita? Okay, we're back to Shechita. Amar Rabbi Zera Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Zera says the name of Shmuel. Liben Sakin Veshachapa Shechitato Kesheira. Hiduda Kodem Libuna. That's it's a teaching here of Shmuel. Libain. Now, the term Libain is from Lavan, white. Libain is to heat something white hot. To heat something white hot. So in other words, if you heat the knife so that it is very hot, Libain Sakin, Rishachapa, and then you use that for Shechita. You got a problem with that knife. The knife is very hot. Anything that is so hot will cause damage. It will cause damage because of the heat. If you cause damage to the animal, you could be killing the animal by virtue of the heat. And remember that in order for shechita to be effective, you have to kill the animal through the slicing action. Through that one action. But he says, Libein Sakin Beshachata, if you heat the knife to be white hot, and you slaughter with it, Shechita Tokeshera, your Shechita is kosher. Chiduda Kodem Lelibuna. Chiduda, the knife's sharpness, precedes its heat. The knife's sharpness precedes its heat. In other words, the edge of the knife is so sharp that the knife itself will cut. And we can't say that the knife is burning because the animal is going to die from the cut before it dies from the burn. Okay? Then the Gemara says, Baha ikat stadim. But what about the sides of the knife? Right? If you heat the knife, the sides of the knife are going to burn. They're going to burn the animal. So don't, I mean, when you're cutting, you're not only cutting with the edge, but the knife goes in and it creates a cut. It's got to go through the tusimamim, through the windpipe and through the jugular. So it's got to go through that. So that's the Gemara. The trachea and the esophagus before the slaughter is completed. Beit hashchita mirvach ravach. The Gemara then answers, the place of the incision spreads as it is cut. Which is probably logical. When you make such a cut, there's tension in the place that you're cutting. And therefore, as soon as you cut it, it separates. It sort of just naturally will pull apart. So the objection that the side of the knife is somehow hampering the cleanliness of the cut, that's not a real objection, because in fact the side of the knife is irrelevant because it's only the edge that is being affected. Okay?
But the heat destroys the sharp edge. If you really heat the knife to that degree that it becomes white,
the Gemara is not, but the Gemara is assuming that the problem is not with the edge being distorted. It's assuming that. Okay? Okay. Now, the Gemara at this point goes into a discussion of Sara'at, of leprosy, which is obviously the next thought. Closely related, because it has to do with this issue of the way the knife worked. So I'd like to skip that and we'll go on a little bit. It's going to 8A3. This is down on 8A, toward the bottom of the page. Amar Rav Nachman. 8A3, it's on the left side in the English. you're following in the Hebrew, it's about less than a quarter, about a fifth of the way from the bottom of the page.
7 lines from the bottom.
There you go. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Bar Avua. Okay? Rav Nachman says in the name of Rabba Bar Avua, Sakin shel avodat kochavim mutar lishchot pa vasur lachtoch pa basar. It's a very interesting idea, and this is going to lead us to some actually relevant issues. A knife that is used for idolatry, okay, the knife is going to be used for the slaughter of an animal. Mutar lishchotpa. You are allowed to use it for slaughtering with it. Vasur lachtokpa basar, but you can't cut meat with it. So that's very perplexing. First of all, you would assume that a knife used that would be for avodah zarah, for idolatry, you couldn't use for shechita. So this is perplexing.
It's consistent with what we learned last week, I think, where he was describing the kashrut part comes after the salting and the soaking.
Okay, well, it's kind of interesting. You can see that this could go in different ways. Is there a comment here? Ariel, was that you? What were you saying?
Sadie?
Could be, that's possible, but I think initially it's kind of hard to understand.
Did we say something else earlier about the knife is resistant to tamei?
Was resistant, but then there was the problem whether the simple cutting itself could the animal have contact with it.
I don't remember, is it completely resistant or is it just one layer lower?
It was one layer lower, right. All right, let's go on. Mutar lishchotba, one is permitted to slaughter with it, mikalelhu, because the slaughter damages the animal. Now, here it is saying that in order to be subject, you know, the limitations of doing anything that is for the purpose of using something that was used for avodah zarah, for idolatry, is only if you're deriving benefit from it. You're deriving benefit from it. But killing an animal is, interestingly enough, considered to be not deriving benefit, but a kilkul. It is damaging the animal. Why? Because an animal is worth more alive than dead. A live animal is an animal that you could use for food. You might use the animal for lugging things around. You could use the animal as a stud for husbandry. There are a variety of things that you can do with a live animal. A cow, you could use it for milk. So there are many things that you could do with a live animal. Therefore, once you kill an animal, actually you take away from its value rather than add to its value. Okay? So that is the way the Gemara understands this. Mutar lishchot ba nekalkelhu, v'asur lachtoch ba, but it is prohibited to cut with it, mitakenu. When you cut something, you're actually increasing its value. Once the animal is dead, you're making it easier to sell, you're butchering it, and at that point, cutting is actually increasing the value of something. So here, at least as far as the Gemara is concerned right now, the laws of avodah zarah are such that you have to derive benefit from something that was used for idolatry in order for it to be prohibited. Correct. I'm not saying this is easy to accept. It seems to me that this is definitely a problem here. First of all, because it's being used in any way for idolatry. I mean, the threshold here is a difficult threshold to understand, so that there is an effort to justify the statement of Rav Nachman and Rabbi Bar Avua, but I'm not satisfied that it's justifiable yet. Okay? Is there someone over here? Well, but we read before that all kinds of people could be shochtim.
It's a sinful pleasure to see the feminine.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, you're dealing with your own animals, you're slaughtering an animal, and your neighbor is an idolater, and you can't find a knife, and you say, you know, Joe, I borrow your knife. And he says, well, yeah, it's very sharp. So you use it. Question is it a valid shchita? It's used by an idolater. The assumption here is that an idolater at least might have used it for idolatry. Well, we don't really know that he did, but he might have used it for that. The assumption is that anything that he does as an idolater.
As long as it's not Wilka idolater.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Because, now there's another issue here. You might react also to saying, well, this was a non-kosher animal, the adulterous animal, which could mean it was a pig. It would be any kind of a non-kosher animal. Not only saying that it's an animal that wasn't shechted properly, but it could be any kind of an animal. So the knife has contact with the animal. So one question that's sort of lurking behind this is, to what extent is contact an issue in the acceptability of the knife? Keep in mind that this is a basic question in kashrut as far as milk and meat goes. Or let's say you want to buy a set of knives on eBay. Okay, because somebody's selling saboteur knives for $19.99 on eBay. Whole set of knives. Okay? So your assumption has to be that the knives are trefa knives. So what? Who is to say that a trefa knife can't be used in a kosher kitchen? That's the question here. Or that's a possible question also that we need to keep in mind. To what extent is contact determinative in making something not kosher? Or is that not determined?
There's a whole slew of rules about that.
Well, where do you think they come from? This is the way the discussion is now beginning. This is, you see, it's...
Was it not why we just read about the remains? I mean, why was...
Oh. Now, that is also possible. That we saw here the issue of libane, to heat something up, and you will see as we move on here, there'll be different terms used, but heat becomes an issue. So the whole discussion is introduced with some mention of heat, although it's not directly, doesn't, you know, follow logically, but there is a mention of heat. We move from there to something bizarrely different, which is idolatry. And we see that it's possible that the knife is still usable, which is somewhat surprising. Okay? Pe'amim sha'shol amar Rava. Pe'amim sha'sholchet asur. There are times when the act of slaughtering with a knife of idolatry is forbidden, in the sukkenet, where the animal was dangerously ill. Oh, so he's saying that, look, if the animal was dangerously ill, the animal isn't worth much alive. So the animal is worth more when it's dead. So you just told me that killing an animal really decreases its value, and so you're not deriving benefit from it. Well, what if the animal isn't in such good shape?
Can I be kosher?
Well, we're not saying if it's so seriously ill.
Just got a cold.
Maybe can't do its other things. Right? You're right. If it were really sick, then that would be a problem. But he's just trying to say that, no, this is, this doesn't make sense. In the chatech mutar, there are certain conditions where cutting something doesn't make it more valuable, but less valuable. And therefore it would be mutar, be permissible. And such as, for example, where someone is dealing with the innards of a sacrifice. Sacrifices that are brought to the altar, their innards have to be dealt with specially, and they are given to the Kohen. Given to the Kohen. And you might decide that these innards that are given to the Kohen, you have a favorite Kohen that you're going to give them to. So this Kohen likes you very much, because every time you offer a sacrifice, you make sure that he gets your imurim, they're called, your imurim. They are the thigh, the chest, what do we call it? Brisket is what, the chest? Okay.
Inside the organ, or inside the...
Well, it's not clear. It is part of the animal. It is not necessarily organs inside, no. This is the thigh of the animal. It's in a chicken. It's the leg of the chicken. Okay. Chicken you can't bring as a korban. Chicken is not, can be offered on the altar. But if there's a sheep, the leg goes to the Kohen. Right? So if you cut that up and you only give him half a leg, he's less happy than if you gave him a whole leg. Right? So that cutting, there are circumstances where cutting is in fact detrimental rather than always adding to value. It subtracts from the value of something. Then the Gemara goes on. But you really should deduce that the knife may never be used on account of the forbidden fat that it all undoubtedly absorbed. Now, a knife that cuts an animal that it shouldn't be cutting comes in contact with all kinds of things that it shouldn't come in contact with. Okay? So you might say, therefore, that really that's its death now. It's the fact that it comes in contact with things that makes it impossible. So then the Gemara says, Bechadasha. No, all we're talking now, this whole previous discussion, we were talking about new knives. So in other words, when we talked about the knife that's used for Avodah Zarah, that's not a knife that was used for Avodah Zarah. That's a knife that was going to be used for Avodah Zarah. So it was just that it had been set aside for that purpose, not that it was used for that purpose. Okay? Bachadasha. So the Gemara then says, Chadasha? What are you talking about? A new knife? Bein Rabbi Yishmael, Bein Rabbi Akiva. Whether we are talking about Rabbi Yishmael or Rabbi Akiva, Mishamshe Avodat Kochavim Hei. Knives are merely accessories of idol worship. Mishamshe Avodat Kochavim Einan Asurim Ad Sheyeavdu. And accessories of idol worship do not become forbidden until they're actually used for idol worship. Okay? So that's what we had said before. Now, the Gemara goes on. Or if you like, I can say, Yipasak bei gavza la'avodat kochavim, that someone chopped wood with a knife for the purpose of idol worship. So, in fact, this was used, even though it wasn't used for the animal, it was used for chopping wood. And that the wood was going to be then used for idolatry. V'i bayatema b'yishana shalivna b'ur. Where now the Gemara may be talking about an old used knife that was superheated in fire. Here we go. We're back to Libna. All of this really partly to get to this point. Where you have a problematic knife, as far as kashrut goes, we saw mention made here of the knife going through things. There was a question about, and we'll come to this again, whether simply cutting is enough to transform the knife. Let us say that a knife is a problematic knife. How do you deal with a problematic knife? The ideal way is libun, is to heat it up. In the laws of kashrut, taste is what is compelling. It is their laws of taste. And objects absorb taste. Now, you know, this is, any great cook will tell you that your pots have a certain taste to them. And certain pots absorb more than other things. They don't always absorb, and they absorb. Heat affects absorption of things. But basic to the laws of kashrut is the notion that heat can purify something of anything that has until that point been absorbed into it. Okay? So if something has absorbed a forbidden taste, libun is at least one way of getting rid of that forbidden taste. Okay? Any questions here? That's not the only way. According to the laws of kashrut, kivola kach polta. The way a thing absorbs is the way that it spits out, literally. So that when you kosher a pot, for example, you kosher a pot the same way that the pot was made unkosher. Because you normally boil water in a pot. That's normally the way you use a pot. A pot is used on top of the stove. If you were going to use something to heat it up tremendously, you would probably do that in the oven. Okay? So, kavola, as it absorbs, so does it give back. Here the example was libun. Clear? Okay, we go on. Itamar, it was stated, Hashochet b'sakin shel obdei kochavim. Someone slaughters with a knife of an idolater. Rav Amer Omer Kolef. Rabba Babar Chana Amar Madiach. Okay, the knife is a problematic knife. The assumption is that the knife has been in an unkosher animal. So that knife is used. And it's used for shechita. What do you do? Where we said that it's okay. The shechita is kosher. But what do you do with the section of the animal that's come in contact with the knife? So two different ways to deal with it. Rav says, kolef. You have to...
Peel off.
Peel, that's a good word. You have to peel it off. And Rabbi Bar Chana says, Madiach, you wash it off. Because realize that there is a sense here, at least the first point of view, the point of view of Rav, is that the knife itself causes a certain amount of heat. And that heat, simply the act of using the knife causes heat. That heat causes a transmission of that which is non-kosher into that which is kosher. It's not a profound transmission, it's a minimal transition, but therefore you have to peel off that level. Now, this is a very practical issue, as a matter of fact, in buying fish. Can you buy fish in a fish store? You always wonder. Why do you wonder?
I do it anyway.
Yeah, but why do you wonder? What's the issue?
Because use the knife to chop something.
That's exactly the issue. Okay. The question is then, if you buy the fish, the question would be, do you have to cut off an additional piece of the fish, or do you have to wash the fish? Okay? That's
not,
the...
Not do you have to wash the knife, you have to wash the fish.
Fish, correct. Because the knife has had contact... What?
The knife is gone. You can't do anything.
Yeah, you can't do anything with a knife, okay? But the knife has had contact with the non-kosher fish. That's it. Then the knife contacts the fish that you want to eat. Your piece now has a problem. What do you do to solve that problem? Okay? The question is, now, it's not absolutely, no, you can't cook the fish until you solve the problem. Once you solve the problem, you could cook the fish. But how do you solve the problem? Do you have to cut an additional liklof that you have to cut a little bit more off the fish? No, your knife is not, because your knife goes further. You offset it. You go in a little bit further.
So you never touch the end that was touched.
Correct. You're not going to touch it. You're not going to cut there. You're going to throw that in the garbage. Okay? That would be if Rav's position were correct. Okay? Rav Bar Chana's position is you have to wash it. You have to wash it. That's the practical ramification of such a thing. Here it's in the context of Avodah Zarah, the knife of Avodah Zarah. But practically it has an impact on whether you can buy in a fish store. Okay? There are people, for example, in this neighborhood, and it's known in the neighborhood, some people do this. They carry their own knives when they go to the fish store. They carry their own knives going to the fish store, and they have, you know, they ask for a fresh cut. For a while, Eli's here on 3rd Avenue kept separate knives. I don't believe they do anymore.
They don't, because I inquired about a week ago. If they did it ever, it was probably very brief.
There was a time that they were trying to cultivate. Yeah, there was a sign up that there were kosher knives, that they would cut things with their separate knives. But to my knowledge, it doesn't exist anymore. You did it. Okay. Here you go. So this is very practical. It's a very practical question. Well, they would have a separate board. Yeah. But the board is less of a problem, to tell you the truth. That's exactly right. The board does not create heat. The knife creates heat. Or there's another side to a knife. It may be the same issue. Well, we'll get to it in a minute. I'll just spill the beans first. The knife also creates pressure. Okay, just as a mechanical issue. If you have a taste that is, for some reason, problematic, when you cut something, there's no doubt about the fact that you are creating pressure. Whether that is also tantamount to the creation of heat, I'm not sure. But there are two issues here. One is heat and one is pressure. And both could be problematic issues.
When does the 160th rule kick in? And does that pertain here at all?
That, interestingly enough, is not brought up here. It is simply not brought up here because now we're dealing specifically with the issue of knives. Knives are dealt with somewhat differently.
When you gave us the information about Avota Tuma, and we went down through the different levels, and we came to the point, then the metal, the last item that we touch, doesn't absorb Tuma. So why suddenly we deal with the knife that absorbs Tuma?
Because this is not an issue of Tuma. Tuma has its... No, you could eat Tuma. You could eat it. You could eat something.
It should not be kosher. I need to lekalef, or I need to...
Kosher is not the same as Tuma. The different laws that affect whether something...
I can eat Tuma.
You can eat Tuma, correct.
And the Tuma can become kosher.
Correct. Because all of us are Tamei. Realize that all of us are presumed to be ritually impure. We're all ritually impure. So if the source of Tuma is death, let's say contact with death, it's not a problem, because we're all in contact with death, so it's not an issue. If the source of tuma is nevela, that's different. Nevela is a death of an animal itself from a non-kosher slaughter. Then, of course, by definition, it can't be eaten. But if it's just contact, that's different.
So where is the parallel of tuma with tuma is good and one tuma with another tuma is not good? How do we know?
It's another subject. It's just not the same subject. I don't enter that subject because it's not the same subject. This is a different issue. Different issue.
Fundamental question. I thought heat is good, isn't it? Heat is heating something up.
Well, it can be good or it can be bad, because if you heat something up, let's say, I get this question once in a while. If somebody puts okay, you take cold meat knife and you put it in the butter. Okay? You have a meat knife. You have a meat knife and you put it in butter. By accident. Okay? That's relatively easy to solve. You know how you solve that?
You put it into earth.
No.
Running water.
You wash it. You wash it.
I haven't done custom.
Wait, you're going to get to it in the Gemara. You're worried about this. You're jumping ahead. The Gemara is going to talk about that. Okay?
Don't you have to put it in a natural spring of running water?
Patience. All these things that we think we know, they're coming from here. They're all going to come from this Gemara. So, where are we?
The knife
and the butter, right. Knife and the butter. But let's say you use that knife, you put the... you were making scrambled eggs. You put the butter in the pan. You heated it up and you stuck the knife in it. Now you got a problem. Why didn't you have a problem the first time and you have a problem the second time? Because the second time it was hot. Heat is crucial because heat passes from one thing to another. Okay? So once you have the introduction of heat, the only way to undo it is with the introduction of heat. Before you have the introduction of heat, you can undo a situation without using heat. Okay, so it's actually easier to undo. Okay, so that's a very basic issue in the laws of kosher. Okay, and we've got a little bit more time. We'll go a little bit further. Okay, we're not going to make a decision here yet about who's right. We'll get to that. Lema baha mifoged. Shall we say that they differ over the following point? This is Rav and Rava Bar Chama. Demar sava beit ashchita sonein. That one master held that the place of the incision is cold. And the other held that the place of the incision was hot. Here we have two different ways of dealing with a problem. Okay, one says that you have to peel it off. What would that be? Cold or hot?
Cold.
Hot.
That would have to be hot. Because hot would cause absorption. Right? Hot would cause the absorption. Cold would not cause absorption, and therefore you could wash it off. You could just wash it off. So perhaps the difference then between these two points of view is that they had a difference of point of view on whether the shechita itself was hot or cold. Now that could be either for two reasons. Either because the very act of shechita created heat, or whether it just happened to be a phenomenon of that particular shechita, that it was a hot knife. We don't know. Okay? But heat is going to be a crucial piece of the datum here. Okay? Now the Gemara says, no, that's not what they disagreed about. The kuliyama beta shechita rateachu. Both of the rabbis took the point of view that beta shechita, where you are making the cut, that is hot. Both assumed it was hot. Mandiamar Kolev Shapir, the one who said you have to peel it, that's understandable, because if both of them assume that the act is one of heat, then we understand why the one said that you have to peel it. But we don't understand what the other guy was getting at. The guy who says you just have to wash it, what is that? Umandiamar Madiach. He has the opinion that since the pipes are busy expelling blood, they do not absorb anything. So the act of cutting, yes, you're right, it creates heat. It creates heat. We could say that. Both of them agree. But once you do a cut, what happens at the moment of cutting? The blood comes out. The blood comes out. So the very act of the blood coming out takes away any of the taste that would have been in the knife itself. So that's sort of, both of them take the point of view, however, that shechita is roteach, that it's hot. Okay, that the act of shechita itself creates heat. To be continued.
Thank you.